Welcome to the Capital News. I'm your host, Alex Caritas. Today is Thursday, October 29th, 2020. Thank you so much for joining me. The title of today's podcast, GDP, the jobless and voting. So a lot to get to today. Some market performance, of course, an update to the initial jobless claims figures for last week, Federal Reserve's balance sheet, M2 money stock, update to the early vote count as it stands this evening. An update to Real Clear Politics. There was some change with respect to their projections for the Electoral College, and the same for 538.com. So a lot to get to. Let's kick it off with GDP. For the third quarter, came in at an initial reading of 33.1%. Of course, that is to the upside. A big number. In fact, the largest number ever in U.S. history. This, of course, is no surprise to the Capital News. We have been discussing this for weeks, if not months, because we understand this thing called math. And when you have the worst quarter in recorded U.S. history in the second quarter of this year, with a decrease of 31.4%, well, you know what? It's not too hard from a very low number, from a very low base, to get a reading of 33.1% in the third quarter. But you have to understand math a little bit further. Now, this is in the right direction, of course. You want it to go up. But how many trillions of dollars did we have to print, spend, beg, and borrow to throw into the system to generate this number? And it doesn't even get us back to where we were. We still have a long ways to go. Because if you lose 31.4% to get back to even, ladies and gentlemen, you don't gain 31.4%. You don't need a gain of 33.1%, which we got in the third quarter. You need a gain of 45.7% to get back to where you were. That is huge. And the other question you have to ask, of course, because Q3 is in the books, well, what's the fourth quarter going to look like? And what is 2021 going to look like? Well, not too good, is it? Because a lot of the structural issues that led us to this mess have not been addressed and are not being addressed and are not going to be addressed. Furthermore, free was never so expensive. All of this free money they claim, having zero consequences, well, that ain't true either. It's going to have significant consequences, significant costs. And all it bought us was a few months to this juncture to get a third quarter GDP print of 33.1%. And don't forget, and I know it's easy to forget because there's so much going on, but we printed a negative number for the first quarter of this year, too. A contraction of 5%. Okay? 5%. Don't forget that. That's January, February, and March. According to Thunder Thumbs and Company, this was still the greatest economy ever at the end of 2019 going into 2020. Well, then why and how did we have a contraction of 5% in the first quarter? How could that have happened? Because COVID-19 didn't really strike us with any type of economic shutdown until late February, mid-March, depending on where you were. And when we get to initial jobless claims, I'm going to refresh our memories on some of those figures too. So what was going on? Well, those of you who have been with us here at the Capital News knows perfectly well what has been going on. The economy was running out of steam. It was kept alive, chugging along at the expense of trillion-dollar deficits before COVID-19. It's an inconvenient truth for Republicans and fiscal conservatives, but they don't want to hear it. And now, what's going to happen now in the fourth quarter? What's going to happen with the election? Is there going to be the Nobody Cares Act 2.0? Is that ever going to be rolled out, or is this just going to continue with the consolidation of major corporations just sucking everybody else up? Bye-bye mom-and-pop shop. Bye-bye small business, even some mid-tier companies. How much more are they going to do? because we don't have it. I'll tell you what we do have, though. We have $27 trillion in debt. We got a $4.2 trillion national deficit. That's not addressed. Thunder Thumbs doesn't want to print that on his Twitter feed. But he'll print the 33.1% gain in Q3. But he doesn't talk about the decline in the second quarter, does he? Never does. Only what looks good for him. And again, at any expense. And he even tweeted out with respect to initial jobless claims coming in at a 7-month low, which sounds good and, of course, in the right direction, but fails to leave out the number. Still 1,000 Americans. There are lies, damned lies, and there are statistics. So that's some of the GDP noise. And it's basic math. We've seen this coming from a mile away. Still a lot to gain to get back to where we were. Yes, right direction, but how did we get here? Printing several trillion dollars and spending it, throwing it into the economy, picking winners and losers. So that's not going to be good. In fact, it would have been much better if we didn't do that and we had back-to-back quarters, negative 30-plus percent. Yes, devastating. I understand. But this would have been part of the correction. This would have been free market forces doing what they do best. We would be much better off. I know it's hard to imagine that, but we would be. Because what these idiots have done has created the environment that has put us in the greatest depression. And if you haven't checked out those podcast series where we go back and do a little history lesson as to what was conducted 1929 after the stock market crash and thereafter, it's the same stuff. Those actions led to the Great Depression. These actions are leading us into the greatest depression. And in fact, we're already in it. And 2021 will likely start to play that out. Market performance, due to the market sell-offs over the past couple of days, a little bit of a bounce back in the stock market across the board, maybe off the back of a better-than-expected number on initial jobless claims and U.S. GDP for the third quarter beating some estimates as well. But nonetheless, in the green for today. Overnight dollar index trading is at 93.788, a little bit of a gain during the day. The euro is trading at $1.16, almost $1.17, to the U.S. dollar, taking a big hit over the past couple of days. So that's also something to be mindful of as the European Central Bank continues to prime their press and wants to have, I guess, at the end of this year, some sort of monetary policy review. They're all going to congratulate themselves and then just do more of what they're doing. Overnight futures trading, Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 0.8%. The S&P 500 is also down 0.8%. NASDAQ 100 is also in the red, giving back 1.2 percentage points. Japanese cash trade is also giving back about 0.7%. A little bit of a mixed bag across the pond in Europe, but given their massive sell-offs, a little bit of a relief for them for certain, but most were in the red again. Australian cash trade is also down about 0.3%. Some of the major tech companies reported earnings this evening. Some beats, some misses, depending on what metric you're looking at. Some recent pops overnight trading, but it does appear that some of those are now in the red. So we'll obviously see what happens tomorrow, but what leads up is likely going to lead down. So if these tech companies, if they have reached their max valuations, their max market caps, well, then they have nowhere else to go but down. And if they do come down, it's going to bring everything else with it. So it is something to be mindful of moving forward. On the commodity front, we have WTI trading at $36.33, Brent at $37.79, both breaking some technical analysis points. So could we be headed lower? That appears to be the direction, but of course, anything can happen. Natural gas is still hanging on pretty well at $3.33. Gold and silver. Gold is at $1,876 an ounce. Silver is currently up 1% at $23.53. So it's interesting to see how investors are treating gold and silver. At this juncture with what's going on with the election, with the surge in COVID-19 cases, particularly in Europe and here in the United States with the lockdown restrictions in Europe. It's anybody's guess how this is all going to play out. The markets, pretty much all of them, are overvalued to some extent. I don't think that that is the case with respect to precious metals, but that doesn't mean that I'm right. I'm a small fish in a big ocean, and the market could have its way with me with respect to my bullish argument and thesis with respect to precious metals. But I just think with what's going on, all the debt, all the money printing, et cetera, the geopolitical uncertainty, that's one of the safest places to be, at least as part of a diversified portfolio nonetheless. But it could go down significantly too. We saw that back in March and April. Gold and silver getting sold off drastically with, I mean, it's basically the baby getting thrown out with the bathwater. But gold did come back pretty quickly. So it's something to be mindful of as well. And then to round it out, we have the 10-year junk note here in the U.S. yielding 0.81%, so maintaining that 8 handle. Of course, we'll keep you updated on that. So there you have it for some of the GDP figures, market performance. Next, let's get into initial jobless claims. So, just for a little history lesson, again, just to refresh everybody's memory, prior to the shutdowns and everything, got to go all the way back to March, okay? We're talking 200,000 jobs per week was initial jobless claims. Those were the figures. Hard to believe. I mean, this is for October of last year, November, December, January, February this year, 200,000, give or take, okay? That was the weekly number. Now, you get all the way into the middle of March, March 14th, 282,000. So you started to see that pickup in initial jobless claims, all right? Again, March 14th. So that goes to my point that we had a first quarter contraction of 5%. That's big, all right? Third quarter ends at the end of March. And then, of course, subsequently, a couple weeks after that, at the end of March, that's when we had that staggering, heartbreaking figure of 6.8, 6.9 million Americans filing for initial jobless claims. That's when we saw that, and it's been coming down ever since, but in still stubbornly high figures. Finally breaking below that 800,000 threshold really last week. You know, there was a one-off back in early October, but then it came right back up over 800,000. But nonetheless, just for your little history lesson there, we were at 200,000 steadily, consistently, and now we're talking 800,000, 700,000, still several months after the fact. So it is still a big issue. For the week ending October 24th, initial jobless claims come in at 751,000. The week prior for October 17th was revised upward and now stands at 791,000. For the week ending October 17th, for continuing jobless claims, the number is at 7.8 million. This is a decrease from the prior week of 709,000, so in the right direction. Taking everything together, persons claiming UI benefits in all programs, again, that's regular state, federal employees, newly discharged veterans, pandemic unemployment assistance, pandemic emergency UC, both of those are the children of the Nobody Cares Act, extended benefits, state additional benefits, and a work share program, the grand total comes to 22.6 million Americans with a two-week lag, so this is for the week ending October 10th. Biggest decrease came from regular state benefits, a decrease of 920,000. Unfortunately, we witnessed an increase in both of those Nobody Cares Act programs. With respect to the Pandemic Unemployment Assistance, PUA, an increase of 172,000. With respect to the Pandemic Emergency UC, or PEUC, an increase of about 387,000. And again, with respect to those programs that were instituted via the Nobody Cares Act, those are for contractors, those are for small businesses, those are for gig workers. So the fact that we continue to see those numbers inching higher week after week really, I think, is going to lend itself to the upcoming jobs report, which, of course, we're not going to get before Election Day. but probably is going to be adding to those permanent job losers, that figure, which is what you have to pay attention to, because that's part of the structural issue that needs to be focused on, not just the headline figure. Got to look under the hood. So that's what we've been paying attention to. And unfortunately, that number, permanent job losers, has been going higher. And then if you're paying attention to some of the other financial media, you're hearing other massive layoffs in some big corporations. Boeing has announced several thousand more. Unless the airline industry gets another bailout, they're going to lay off tens of thousands more. HSBC, a huge bank, which we are concerned about here at the Capital News, up to 35,000 jobs over the next couple of years, and that could happen at any moment. I'm concerned about General Electric, and we've done a couple of podcasts specifically on Boeing and General Electric. You can check those out. Those seem to be pretty popular with the audience. Those are not on the back burner. Those are still problems that are brewing, and we continue to prop up one zombie corporation after the next, and that is just killing any type of future growth. So just be mindful of all of that. Now to the Federal Reserve's balance sheet, a slight decrease from the week prior. This is a natural runoff, if you will. This is a little technical here, but with the asset purchases that they have duration, whether it's their bonds, bills, notes, whatever they're purchasing, or with respect to the mortgage-backed securities that they also purchase. So when some of those expire, they run off naturally from the balance sheet. That's what's happened here. The balance sheet currently stands at $7,146 billion. $7,146 billion. That is a slight decrease from the prior week, about $31 billion, which was an all-time high last week, where it stood at $7,177 billion. Don't worry, it's going back up. Then if you want to take a look at M2 Money Stock, which of course we do, again, making another all-time high, $18,815 billion. These numbers are just very difficult to comprehend, but that's where we are. Year-over-year basis, this is an increase of 24.1%. Year-over-year increase. Now you say, well, what does that mean? Well, maybe we've had this type of increase before. Well, the data I'm looking at, courtesy of the Federal Reserve, going back to 1980, so 40 years worth of data, no, we have never seen this type of year-over-year increase with respect to M2 Money Stock. Again, we're at 24%. You have to go all the way back. Where are we at here? 1982, 1983, to get it 12.7%. I mean, just look at these graphs, ladies and gentlemen. You don't have to be a genius. You don't have to be an economist. You don't need any type of formal training to know that this isn't right, that this is unsustainable, that something is amiss here. It's right in your face. Same thing with the actions that they are doing, picking the winners and losers. How people can vote for these two parties is beyond me, but that's what's going to happen, and we're going to continue to see more of this. Now on to the updating of the early vote count. This, again, is from the U.S. Elections Project, courtesy of Professor Michael McDonald out of the University of Florida. Data updated as of 10:52 p.m. Eastern Time, 81.3 million votes. 81.3 million in-person voting, accounting for 28.4 million mail ballots, accounting for 52.9 million mail ballots outstanding, 37.4. So again, the grand total as of now, 81.3 million, a huge number. And even now, if we get to a turnout of 160 million, which is at the high range of what some political analysts have been projecting here, we're halfway there. This is staggering, and we still have tomorrow, and depending on where you are, you could have the weekend. And of course, mail-in ballots will continue to come in. So we're going to continue to update the audience until Election Day. This is staggering, and it's good to see people voting, but of course, it's unfortunate that there's not enough education out there to understand what's going on right in your face, but that's another story. That's why I do these podcasts. But turnout as a percent of 2016 total turnout now stands at 59%. 5%, so a staggering figure. And we could have that again for the same percentage turnout of 2020, or maybe higher. Still a long ways to go. But on a percentage basis, Texas is at 95%. Unbelievable, 95%. Swing state or battleground state of Arizona is at 80.4%. Nevada is at 82%. Florida at 77%. Georgia at 82%. North Carolina at 81%. Commonwealth of Pennsylvania at 34%. Ohio at 46%. Michigan at 50%. Wisconsin at 55%. Minnesota at 40%. Iowa at 54%, rounding up slightly. Staggering figures. And again, the higher this number goes, the more likely it is that we can have some vote counts taking place earlier. It all depends on the state as to when they can start counting and processing those ballots. Some can do it the morning of Election Day. Others have to wait until all of the polls close. But with this type of count, we may very well know who wins the presidency within a couple of days. Could happen on election night, depending on how some of the states go. Again, if Joe Biden should win the state of Florida, that's pretty much it for Donald Trump. But Florida is typically a red state that sometimes swings blue, as they say. Now to Real Clear Politics, just to update their projection, because they have changed. They're no toss-up states, which is what we have been going over for the past couple of days. Again, Real Clear Politics, looking at their average of polls and any other type of methodology that they utilize. If you go to their website, realclearpolitics.com, click on their Electoral College map, and then click on No Toss-Up States. So if they're basically forced to make a decision who wins which states, this is the final picture, according to Real Clear Politics. Past couple of days, it's been steady. Biden had 311. He now has 356 Electoral College votes. Trump now has 182. What has changed? Florida in Georgia. And I even think Iowa is now in the Biden camp. No, I'm sorry. Just Florida and Georgia, doing the quick math in my head. Just flipping Florida and Georgia gives Joe Biden an additional 45 Electoral College votes. That's why Florida is so crucial to any type of path to victory for the president and his reelection bid. So that's a big move in one day, gaining 45, especially Georgia. You can understand Florida maintaining a Republican lean. But even that flipped. Georgia, I mean, that flipping to Joe Biden, I mean, is this sort of having a bad taste in the voters' mouths with respect to Stacey Abrams and the gubernatorial election that took place there a couple years ago? Is that still bitter in a lot of people's mouths? So is that causing a lot of enthusiasm to get people out there to vote? Now, we don't know if it's going to go for Joe Biden, but with some of these early votes, knowing that Democrats are sort of the bigger cohort right now, again, that doesn't mean that they're voting for the Democratic ticket. It doesn't mean that they're voting for Joe Biden and Kamala Harris, but it would seem to reason, especially when we look at some of the polls as well. So let's get to some of that. This is out of 538.com. Titled their article today, "The Battleground States Where We've Seen Some Movement in the Polls." In states like Pennsylvania and North Carolina, which have largely remained the same. And those are crucial battleground states for both candidates. With apologies to the raconteurs, the presidential race continues to be steady as she goes, with little sign of tightening, despite a plethora of new polls. 538's presidential forecast gives Joe Biden an 89-in-100 shot at winning the election, while President Trump has just an 11-in-100 chance. This makes Biden the favorite, but still leaves open a narrow path to victory for Trump, for whom a re-election win would be surprising, but not utterly shocking. At the same time, We also have fewer pulls from live caller surveys, which have historically been more accurate and have shown slightly better numbers for Biden than polls that use other methodologies, such as polls conducted primarily online or through automated telephone calls. Nevertheless, while the overall picture has shifted only a little in recent days, a few battleground states have seen at least some movement in their polls, which has slightly altered the odds Biden or Trump wins in each of those places. For instance, we've gotten three new high-quality polls today from Florida that were in the field through at least Tuesday. And although these polls have helped Biden a tad, they actually tell a pretty mixed tale compared to each pollster's last look at the Florida situation. For instance, NBC News' Marist College gave Biden a four-point lead, 51% to 47%, which was a narrow improvement for Biden from the tied race Marist found in early September. However, Quinnipiac University found Biden ahead by just 3 points, 45% to 42%, which marked a sizable slide from the 11-point edge it gave in early October. And yesterday, Reuters Ipsos also reported a small downturn in Biden's numbers, as their poll found him up 2 points, 49 to 47, a slight tick down from his 4-point lead about a week ago. Bottom line, Florida is close, like it always seems to be. And of course, Florida is now the new home state of President Trump, and he has been campaigning there vigorously, as has been Joe Biden. But of course, it is the home state of Donald Trump, as I just stated, that can carry some weight. From Florida, we can slide our gaze north of the St. Mary's River to look at Georgia, where we've actually seen a more sizable shift in Biden's direction over the past few days. Biden now has a 57-in-100 chance of winning Georgia, up from 46-in-100 on Monday. This is important because Georgia is a state that Trump absolutely must win to have any chance of victory, according to 538. In fact, he wins in less than 1% of the scenarios in which Biden carries it being the state of Georgia. So that's why Joe Biden was spending some time in Georgia. They understand the math as well. That's why Donald Trump even had to go to Georgia last week. They understand the math. We have one new poll today that largely aligns with recent polling that has boosted Biden's chances in Georgia. Democratic pollster Public Policy Polling put Biden ahead by 2 points, 48% to 46%, essentially the same as what the pollster found in early October. Meanwhile, Monmouth University released a Georgia survey yesterday that gave Biden a 2-point or 4-point lead, depending on projected turnout among likely voters, which marked a swing from the pollster's mid-September poll that had Trump ahead by 2 or 5 points, again, depending on turnout. And what we're currently seeing in turnout, it seems to be there. But the short of it in Georgia is that results showing Biden slightly ahead or tied with Trump have become more common. In fact, Trump has only led in 2 Georgia surveys out of the 13 released in the past 10 days. That's quite shocking. Ohio is another state where Trump seemed to have a slight edge, but is now more of a toss-up, as our forecast has swung towards Biden and gives both candidates a 1-in-2 shot of winning, or in other words, 50-50. And I do believe, historically speaking, no Republican president has ever won if he has lost Ohio. So in order to win the White House, a Republican needs to carry, doesn't need to, but historically has always carried Ohio with him. But we are now at 50-50 in Ohio. 2 new polls out today precipitated this shift toward Biden, moving the state's polling average from a 2-point Trump lead to a tie. Most importantly, Quinnipiac University found Biden up by 5 points, 48% to 43%, which was a fairly substantial improvement for Biden from Quinnipiac's last survey in early October that had him up by just 1 point. So that takes into consideration, obviously, more campaigning and that final debate. That poll was the main driver of the shift today in Ohio, because not all of the news was good for Biden in Ohio. Gravis Marketing found Trump ahead in their latest poll, 49% to 47%. This was Gravis' first public poll of Ohio, for what that's worth. However, some other key states haven't seen much movement despite new polling. For example, we've seen a couple of new polls in Pennsylvania since late yesterday that both give Biden a lead in the mid to high single digits. And one was even a high-quality live caller poll, which we've lacked here to some extent, which amazes me personally because everybody knows the importance of Pennsylvania, and there just doesn't seem to be that many high-quality polls being taken. But, of course, there's still tomorrow and the weekend for more to come out. But they didn't change the forecast outlook. Biden still has an 86 in 100 chance of winning there, according to 538. Neither new poll showed much of a change from its previous Pennsylvania survey either. The aforementioned live caller survey from Quinnipiac University that came out today found Biden up 7 points, 51% to 44%. But that was practically identical to what it found in the middle of October. Similarly, Political IQ RMG Research's new survey gave Biden a 6-point advantage, 51% to 45%, the same margin the pollster found in early October. We're watching Pennsylvania especially closely, as any movement here matters a lot in our forecast, as it's the state currently most likely to decide the Electoral College. And the margin, as it currently stands, leaves room for Trump to win on November 3rd, or after, as it might take a bit of time to get the final result there. Like Pennsylvania, North Carolina is another state where the forecast has hardly budged in the past few days. Biden now has a 65 in 100 shot of carrying the state, but it's been around that mark since last weekend. And pretty much the same story continues. Last paragraph, however, on the whole, the top line numbers in this race haven't changed much. On the one hand, that's good news for Biden as he remains a favorite to win the presidency. That is, if the polls mostly hold where they are, it will take a sizable polling error for Trump to win. However, Biden's advantage would be more concrete were his position in Pennsylvania to improve in the closing days of the campaign. So we'll just have to see if anything shifts in the final days that changes the trajectory of the race. So there you have it from 538. And since we updated, or at least our Real Clear Politics, RCP, updated their Electoral College, I just want to share that also with what 538 did as well when you look at their national polls. So again, Biden, 89 in 100 chance of winning. Trump, 11 in 100, still has a chance to victory. But nonetheless, 538 sees Pennsylvania, Nevada, Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan going to Joe Biden. They are also giving Nebraska 2, Arizona, Florida, North Carolina, Maine 2, Georgia, and now Ohio leaning towards Joe Biden. That's big. However, Iowa has leaned back into Trump's camp. So I think this is the first time I've ever seen 538 have Ohio in Biden's camp. But of course, it's tied 50-50. Anything can happen. And according to 538, it's Pennsylvania that puts it over the top for Biden and Harris at 270. But of course, there are other avenues that can carry Biden-Harris over the 270 number. Winding down, a few days to go. Thank God. Of course, that might be a little bit premature because all hell might break loose if it's a close election and it comes down to some states that there's the allowance for a few days for mail-in ballots to come in or for further counting to take place, a couple days, a few days, maybe up to 9 days, I think, in North Carolina. So if it's close, it's going to get nasty, no doubt about it, end up to the Supreme Court. And it's anybody's guess what happens there. But, you sort of want to pray for the country that we know who the president is as quickly as possible, because as divided as we are, as high as the stress levels are across the country, having a contested presidential election that goes all the way up to the Supreme Court is not going to bode well for anybody. So let's pray that that doesn't happen. But it very well could. Wouldn't surprise me in the least. But there you have it. Some updated figures across the board. A lot of information we crossed here in just 35 minutes. Hope you enjoyed it. Stay diversified, stay vigilant, and stay with the Capitol News. I am Alex Kritis. Godspeed.